Marshawn Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
My favorite philosopher, Roberto Unger, has this line, "Our ideals are nailed to the cross of our institutions," by which he means that any ideal you have in culture, like America should be this way, or community or culture should be this way, is inextricably linked with the actual designs of our concrete institutions, our policies, our laws, the way we structure organizations. There's no such thing as a free-floating cultural phenomenon or a free-floating institutional phenomenon. The institutions flow into culture, the culture flows into the institutions. Long-winded, heady way of saying, the bowling alone phenomenon of people declining in community is connected to the phenomenon of, you know, our institutions deciding to underinvest in community, and then it flows back and forth. Oh, it looks like people don't want to go to the Elks Clubs anymore. Let's stop funding the Elks Clubs. Oh, now there's no Elks Clubs, so when I look to start joining something, I have nowhere to join, so I don't do community. And then they're like, oh, self-fulfilling prophecy. We don't need the Elks Clubs anymore. Let's just extract some checks and votes to have our people in Washington and New York do things. And I think it's just kind of circles the drain like that.
We are taking a complete and total switch from our foreign policy coverage on Tuesday, episode of Robert Draper on the origins of the Iraq War. A lot of debate in the YouTube and other comments about whether or not President Bush lied, the role of the State Department, the CIA and everything. So go check that out if you haven't listened yet. Today, we are taking a total switch, though, in covering domestic politics, specifically how progressives are addressing their challenges at the state and local level. We have Amanda Littman, co-founder of Run for Something, and Pete Davis, who is the co-founder of the Democracy Policy Network. Something we always talk about on this show is the fact that it is a terrible fact of our politics that local issues are now all nationalized. It's impossible to talk about taking out the trash, local tax policies, the schools themselves without having something big like CRT or coronavirus policy intrude on that. That's not to say that education and COVID obviously aren't important issues, but it's also to say that they crowd out the really important stuff that's going on the ground. So this is a good conversation about how progressives are specifically thinking about these issues.
Yeah, I really enjoyed talking to both of them. They're both honest, good faith people. We hit them with some hard questions. We're like, okay, if progressive policy is so great, then why do you guys get destroyed at the local level and have been over the last decade? Why exactly did Joe Biden do better than Ilhan Omar in her own home state? Those are all good questions. And we, you know, talk a lot about the culture war, about the nationalization of politics. And I would say that they're both good faith people. I think they're legitimately trying to change the system. I'm not sure if I'm optimistic or if I buy some of their explanations, but I enjoyed talking to them both nonetheless.
Really hope you all enjoy this interview. So before we get to that, a couple housekeeping items. Realignment conference shout out. You all know the deal. If you have not submitted, be sure to go check the link in the show notes. Also, a bunch of you should have received notices in your email. Check it out. It's from Eventbrite. Some people have written in saying they haven't heard back, even though we marked them officially as accepted. So be sure to go search there. And if you haven't already, go check it out as well too. Secondly, this is not a book episode, so go check out our bookshop to links to other books and things we're checking out right now. And finally, and most importantly, we are still so blown away by how strong everyone's fiction and nonfiction recommendations are. This is the last call for submissions to our email, realignmentpod@gmail.com, or an Apple Podcast review. We're going to put those out in a Substack, which is going out later this afternoon. You could subscribe to that in the link in the show notes. And once again, we're doing this in lieu of a Q&A session right now. I want to read a quick submission from Andrew Pardue, a longtime listener of the show, who's a really smart guy, and he actually links up with Sagar of My Taste in Books. So this is the type of stuff we're looking to hear from people. Hi, Marshawn Sagar. I'm writing to you with a nonfiction recommendation for you and your listeners. The President and the Assassin, McKinley, Terror, and Empire at the Dawn of the American Century by Scott Miller. This has been my favorite book that I've read in the last year. I suspect that your listeners will find it to be beneficial as well. Much nonfiction is either poorly written, unilluminating, or both, but this book is really engaging, almost cinematic. A narrative about a time in American history that most members of our generation don't know anything about. Leon Czolgosz, yes, I actually already audibled this book 10 years ago,
about how I know how to pronounce a strange name like Chogosh. His dissatisfaction with his socioeconomic lot in life feels particularly contemporary. For those listeners who don't know their U.S. history, Chogosh is the person who shot and murdered President McKinley, who then obviously led to Theodore Roosevelt becoming president. So many things to cover there. Andrew also suggests you check out Rick Perlstein's series on political realignments in the 1960s.
Wow. Yeah, great recommendation. I'll probably go pick it up right after we're done recording this. Thank you, Andrew, and to everybody
else.
And
by pick it up, Sagar means logging into my Audible account. That's a key example of everything.
Do you still have it in there? Do you still own it?
It's one of, okay. This is actually why I shouted this one out, because this was actually one of the first ever Audible books that I purchased, and it's such a good book. Can't recommend it enough. And then I have to include one note of praise from Andrew, because I hope people start recognizing this more. I also want to praise the show, since it's my first time writing in. It's been a particularly good since the election, because I think what distinguishes you both from many other podcasters in this space is your willingness to assimilate contrary and even disappointing data into your worldview. Andrew, thank you so much for noting that. Nothing is worse than having people angrily write in saying, you two promised me that we had the second coming of populism back in 2019. It didn't happen now. We are assimilating contrary data and updating our worldviews. Really good way of putting it. A lot of stuff here. I think unless you have anything last to add, Sagar, we should just jump into the episode. A lot of good stuff here. Hope you all enjoy it.
Thanks as always to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. Let's go.
Amanda and Pete, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you for having us.
Glad to be here.
We are here to discuss a conference the two of you are organizing, State House Futures, which is focused on progressive policy at the state and local level. So the first question to start here, because I'm actually genuinely curious as to your answer, is what distinguishes progressivism at the state and local level? Because we're mostly focused on national politics as a show. So if I were to say, what's the progressive? Who's more center left? I would say, well, the Brookings Institution versus Bernie Sanders. I would say, what's your position on Medicare for All? But those issues and those very DC-centric frameworks aren't going to apply to the local level, let's say in Colorado or Wisconsin. How would the two of you, let's start with you, Amanda, define progressivism in the local context?
Well, I think there's a lot of similarities to the national context, but I think on the state legislative level, they can actually do something with them is what sort of differentiates it. You know, we have things like voting rights legislation, legislation on reproductive choice, on climate change, on infrastructure, on transit, on criminal justice reform. A thing I think that gets lost in the conversation often is that most of the meaningful action that's happening in government at this point is happening on the state and local level. So the progressive values that we espouse and that we at least work towards actually get acted on and executed on. And I think the really interesting stuff that we have seen is, you know, you point out Colorado, the ways in which some of these states have taken those progressive values and transformed them in a way that makes sense for their communities. So like Colorado is working on creating a public option and a public marketplace for their healthcare. New York has expanded early voting. Virginia expanded Medicaid and abolished the death penalty. You know, each of these states has taken these values and really put them into practice.
Pete, do you have anything you want to add on that?
Yeah, you know, the way we see it is the word we like to use is deepening democracy, you know, and we define that as expanding more power to more people in more ways. Another way to go at it is to see freedom not just as liberty from power or government, but participation in power and government. You know, it's a Martin Luther King quote, freedom is participation in power. One final way, I love all the different angles you can come at it. One final way you could go is you could say it's about helping people co-create our shared world, that each of us has a voice in the forces that govern our lives. So the way we see that at the Democracy Policy Network is it's about, one, strengthening people and communities to participate in power. So making sure that people are equipped and empowered to raise their voice and, you know, realize their ideas. But it's also about opening up power. So opening up government and state power to more people in more ways. So taking government institutions and economic institutions and saying, how can we increase participation in that? And that adds together to a deeper democracy. And as Amanda said so well, you know, the this all sounds, you know, this kind of 1 minute thing I just went on is very abstract. Mm-hmm. At the state and local level, it can get really concrete. It looks like public banks and worker ownership and expanding voting and expanding kind of participation in government and some of the other things we're talking about at the summit this week, like democracy vouchers out of Seattle or green buildings out of Washington or drug war abolition out of Oregon. You know, there's all these concrete ways that this abstract spirit manifests.
It absolutely does. I think one of the interesting things, though, is that I kind of grew up in the era where politics was still local. My congressman was a Democrat who represented an R plus 25 district. Like, he was pro-life, but also endorsed Obama. He was this like archetypal Southern Democrat, which just doesn't exist anymore. And I often look at his loss in 2010 as the true nationalization of politics. And like, as much as I would like all politics to be local, I think it's pretty much the opposite now. Georgia's voting legislation becomes a nationwide issue. Oregon drug thing. That's not about Oregon. That's a bunch of nonprofits and others in Washington getting involved. It seems to me that all state and local politics is now national. I've interviewed many progressive candidates and more, and often when they're running in the local races, even congressman level, it's all just about like, well, I support Medicare for all and he doesn't. And it's not really about the district itself. So Amanda, that's my question to you, which is that how do you focus on state and how do you have local politics and differentiate it from the national scale when at the end of the day, like all politics is national? Or am I just completely wrong?
Well, I don't think you're wrong. I think that you have to think about who is doing the evaluating here. There's a lot of factors that have gone into sort of the nationalization of politics, from the demise of local media to the, you know, rise of social media and algorithms to cable news to increased polarization to gerrymandering, which has, you know, furthered that polarization and made it structural. And I think for individual actors, for most voters, when they start to get engaged, the thing that gets them engaged is not a national issue. It's something incredibly personal. It's often a school board fight. It's housing prices. It's the potholes in front of their street. It's whether their teachers or police officers are getting paid enough or too much, depending on what perspective you're coming at it from. Mm. That is the thing that for a lot of activists, and especially for young people of color, is often their entry point into this process. And I do think, you know, you talked about Congress as sort of local. I think for run for something exclusively works with state House, state Senate, and below. Before this, I was talking to a member of the University of Michigan Board of Regents. Later today, I have calls with city council members and school board members. It's the kinds of positions where the work that they're doing is so tangible that it sort of crosses over partisanship. Like, and this is one thing that I think gets lost in Congress, because Congress basically writes bills that become press releases. They don't actually do much, with a couple exceptions. When you're doing governance that has to get done because at the end of the day, the trash has to get picked up, for example, the partisanship falls away a little bit. So I do think for the media and for sort of like, you know, congressional and even to a certain extent, some state legislative stuff becomes nationalized. For personal participation, it feels very local and is often the most sustainable, because you get wins that make it enjoyable to participate in.
Pete, I want to throw this question to you. I wrote this down as you all were articulating the things that are getting accomplished on the local level. What are the limits of state and local politics for progressives? So, for example, I think, Amanda, you brought up public option or healthcare options at the state level. I know that, for example, this was single payer was attempted in Vermont. It didn't work because there's a budgetary constraint that doesn't exist on the national scale level. Mm-hmm. California tried to sort of do this, and that's an economy that's around the eighth biggest in the world, and they still couldn't pull it off. So what are the limits of this type of politics?
Yeah, you know, there are I will start just by saying that I think we way overemphasize the limits, and that our state and local our state and local venues are places of totally wide, much wider than expected for people who aren't tapped into this, experiments and alternative ways of running institutions. And those experiments end up spreading and growing and being brought to Congress. So there's really exciting vanguard cutting edge stuff that you can do at the local and state level. But you're totally right. There are limits where, you know, we work day to day with the Democracy Policy Network on writing up things for state legislators on different issues. And occasionally we run into issues where we say, well, the best you can do as a state legislator is ask your congressional delegation to do this. So let's talk about a few areas. What the biggest one, of course, is funding. So, you know, as the modern monetary theorists will tell you, you know, the federal government has monetary sovereignty that allows them to have a much wider birth of spending than state and local governments. State and local governments actually keep their funding in a literal bank account, mm-hmm. and many of them have balanced budget amendments, and, you know, they have to issue bonds and take out loans, you know, if they want to go over their budget, whereas the federal government doesn't have to do that. And just the largesse of the federal government, even if it is within a budget, it's just so much more. Second is foreign policy, though, can only be done at the federal level, so entering into trade agreements and things like that. Though there is really, you know, we've discovered with DEEPIN, there's amazing things governors can do, mayors can do to build kind of international solidarity and fight against international trade agreements that they don't like. So there still is some wiggle room. The final are things that are preempted at the national level. So the classic example of this is the NLRB, like the, mm-hmm. the labor regime at the national level. If you wanted to do really radical labor experimentation, like have a whole different regime of how unionization happens in your state, you're going to be stopped and preempted by the national, the national labor regime. And so sometimes you run into these bounds of what can be done. But my big emphasis that I'm really trying, you know, I think the average person thinks there's nothing you can do, but, you know, states run their whole criminal legal systems. They run schools. They have their own budget where they can do experiments in totally different ways. We are finding, when you're wondering if something is preempted at the federal level or not, it's more likely than not that it is not, and you have wiggle room, but you run into some situations where it's hard.
I'm going to brand that progressives for federalism, and we'll see how that works. But Amanda, here's my question for you, and this is an obvious one, but it comes up on state and local. Why have Democrats done so badly at the state and local level? Obama famously, I think it was 1,000 state house seats that were lost under him, even though he did win the presidency. Crystal often points to the fact that the nationalization of politics makes it so that we were both recently reading this article about, I think it was Tim Ryan, who's running for Senate. To your point, I know that Senate is more national, but he never once says the word, "I am a Democrat," in his 3-minute ad running in Ohio. Or you have, I believe the state is Montana, where somebody is running at the state house level who, again, is actually running against the National Democratic Party. And Crystal's like, "I'm sorry, this just isn't going to work. All politics is national. You get branded with the Democratic Party national line." I mean, obviously something is going wrong there. So what do you think that is?
I think it's a question of investment. So if you go back to 2009, 2010, Karl Rove writes an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying, "We're going to invest in 100-ish state legislative seats. We're going to put $35 million in. We're calling it Red Map, with the goal of ultimately controlling election administration," meaning they will control a redistricting process after census. You know, they do so, they win. They're then able to control the House. They use that to do all kinds of fucked up shit over the last decade. That's a very, very short version of this. But that is just the tail end of what has ultimately been about 45 to 50 years, since even the 60s or 70s, of Republican investment in local elections. I have heard them and read memos of, it is more important to win 1,000 school board seats than a single presidential office. It's Ralph Reed, leader of the Moral Majority, of focusing on winning judiciaries and investing on local courts. There is not a comparable investment in local elections from the Democratic side. And I think this actually comes from a pretty intuitive place for Republican donors. For Republican mega donors, to invest in Republican elections is a good business investment. is good for their bottom line. It's good for their taxes. They get their judges. Mostly it's good for their taxes. If they do so, it's okay to absorb a couple losses along the way. You can lose one election cycle or two election cycles or four, knowing that at the end of the day, it will be better for your business. Democratic donors, especially wealthy mega donors, are coming at it from a different kind of emotional place. It is not necessarily, I mean, I think it's good for humanity and often good for business, but it's not always a clear-cut good for business for Democratic donors, at least in the last 30 years. I think now it's changing a little bit, but it was not as clear of a direct line. And I do think this has a little bit to do with Obama as well. Democratic donors invest because the candidates are flashy and exciting, because it's inspiring, because the presidential ticket is going to make you an ambassador or invite you to the cocktail party or that you go out with your friends and have something to be really excited about. That is not how Republicans operate. Just isn't. So when we start to think about let's make investments in winning county clerk positions, winning state legislative seats, winning even governorships to a certain extent, those are just not as flashy and as exciting, and they take longer. You have to often lose a little before you win. Democratic donors do not like that, do not like losing. Nobody likes losing, but Democratic donors really don't like losing. So you've had ultimately decades of underinvestment in these positions, which when they start getting compounded by the structural inequities Republicans are building into the process, make it really, really hard for us to win. Which is a really long way of saying is that we are why we're in this messy place to begin with. We are why we did not win a single state legislative house in 2020 and in fact lost two chambers in New Hampshire. We are why we are like losing county board positions and school boards, because to win them would have taken investing 20 years ago.
So a quick thing, but I'll throw this to Pete then, because I'm interested. How much of what you're describing when we're saying we at the state and local level is a Democratic Party problem or is a problem of a lack of progressivism in the sense that if you're looking at 2020, what did Joe Biden do? Joe Biden was very much not the progressive candidate. He very explicitly said, hey, I don't support Medicare for all. He won off of the votes of more socially conservative, older Black voters in the South. So if you were just to diagnose the problem, it seems to me that I'm having a hard time understanding why taking the Democratic Party in a more progressive direction would actually address the problem you're describing in 2020. In fact, in many cases, Joe Biden actually ran ahead of more progressive candidates in states such as Minnesota, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm just curious, Pete first, but then Amanda, how the two of you think about this dynamic.
Yeah, you know, one, there's this lost book in political science that I'm deeply inspired by. It's Theta Scotchpole's Diminished Democracy. And the subtitle says the whole story of the book, From Membership to Management in 20th Century America. And what she said is she talks about two models for how to organize civic life. And I know you're asking about ideology, but I actually think in the end, ideology is the tail behind kind of the civic organizing model. Though ideology really matters and the vision and policy matters, that's what we're all about, is fighting for particular policies and a particular vision. But what I think determines the end is civic structure. So Scotchpole lays out, political scientists at Harvard, lays out two types of ways of organizing civic life, a membership style and a management style. In a membership style, you have local chapters. You meet up regularly in weekly meetings. You have even goofy ceremonies of welcoming individual specific people into those local chapters. You say, welcome, Randall. Thank you so much for joining. We are so glad to have you. We are giving you an initiation. We are giving you a membership card. You feel part of a community. You belong to something. And those membership organizations federate up with regional chapters, state chapters, and a national, you know, convention that they have every year and to elect their national president. And these at the turn of the century were so big that when like Herbert Hoover and Calvin Coolidge were running for president, even up to Roosevelt, you would go on a tour of the Elks Club convention and the NAACP convention and the Hadassah convention. And you'd actually try to get the endorsements. And if you were running for local office, you'd go to the state convention or the local chapter meetings to actually be part of civic life. She said there was a transition to management civics in as the century wore on, where we said, oh, you know, we need to lobby DC. We need to get lobbyists in DC. Why don't we just hire experts to be lobbyists? They're the ones that are actually lobbying for our causes, you know, Audubon Society, Sierra Club, whatever. And, oh, we need all this money for all these lobbyists in DC. And so why don't we just focus on fundraising among our membership? And then you start doing member managers where you're like, let's get more and more fundraising out of them. Let's figure out messaging for them. And then we don't need these ceremonies and these local chapters. That's all old school. Let's just turn them into email lists because the other side's doing mailing lists too, to get votes and donations out of them and not ask anything of them besides votes and donations. And then you have this very centralized civic culture as opposed to a distributed civic culture. And so the whole culture of civics, any political action at all, becomes watching your, you know, cable news network, getting your fundraising emails that say, it's a total emergency this year, biggest year of all years. Please donate $50. You must vote. Vote and donate, vote and donate, vote and donate. That you atrophy the civic muscles. Your eyes turn upward towards the federal level. You think you start belittling the state and local level, like Amanda talks about so well. And we just completely lose our capacity as any political agents or civic movements to be involved. And so I think it's less about, you know, did Joe Biden, you know, endorse this phrasing or that phrasing, and more about, are we going to have a culture where we actively participate and we engage at all three levels of government, not just the federal level, but the state and local level too. And we put our money in institutional structure where our mouth is, where we actually have organizations that are not top heavy, but have the top serve the engagement of the lower levels.
Quick thing, Pete, because I hate to interrupt, but I know that you've done a lot of work on Robert Putnam's work. So the obvious question here is the following. What's the causal relationship here? Because you're suggesting that there was a choice that was made, let's say 60s, 70s, 80s, post-1968, post-Watergate, that whole bit. We've covered this in a bunch of different shows. But it seems that Putnam's work, and maybe I'm misreading, and by misreading I mean repeating conventional wisdom that you haven't actually read any of his books other than our kids, is that the broader civic culture collapsed and then the political culture came. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious, you seem to be suggesting that there was an active choice made to just start ignoring the Elks Clubs, when it seems that my reading would suggest that the Elks Clubs and the civic associations, the friendships, the whole bowling alone thing happened first, and that led to a form of politics that was so individually focused that the only type of thing you could do is send email things. And Amanda, please come in too at some point. But I think this is a fascinating
topic. I'll be quickly so we can get to Amanda, who actually, you know, works on the great alternative of rebuild. You know, it shouldn't just be a gloom and doom decline story. Let's talk about how we can turn it around, which Amanda is one of the great examples of this with Run for Something. But very quickly, you know, my favorite philosopher, Roberto Unger, has this line, our ideals are nailed to the cross of our institutions, by which he means that any ideal you have in culture, like America should be this way, or community or culture should be this way, is inextricably linked with the actual designs of our concrete institutions, our policies, our laws, the way we structure organizations. There's no such thing as a free-floating cultural phenomenon or a free-floating institutional phenomenon. The institutions flow into culture, the culture flows into the institutions. Long-winded, heady way of saying, the bowling alone phenomenon of people declining in community is connected to the phenomenon of, you know, our institutions deciding to underinvest in community, and then it flows back and forth. Oh, it looks like people don't want to go to the Elks Clubs anymore. Let's stop funding the Elks Clubs. Oh, now there's no Elks Clubs, so when I look to start joining something, I have nowhere to join, so I don't do community. And then they're like, oh, self-fulfilling prophecy. We don't need the Elks Clubs anymore. Let's just extract some checks and votes to have our people in Washington and New York do things. And I think it's just kind of circles the drain like that. So long-winded way of saying, I think it's double causal in both ways. Over to you, Amanda, who sees the reality of this every day, though, in your work.
Well, I think you lay the groundwork really well, and the situation of the 2020 presidential election is a really good example of how this plays out in real time, in which the 2020 Biden campaign's primary goal was to win the Electoral College, which meant they had a very specific set of states, and within those states, cities and pockets of voters that they had to reach. Their goal was that and that alone. that meant that their strategic imperatives did not perfectly overlap with the Senate map or the U.S. House map, or especially state legislative maps. You know, in Pennsylvania, for example, they needed to win voters in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and the suburbs and pick up some pockets there. The places we needed to win state House races were the middle of the state. There wasn't a clear alignment in strategic priorities across the ticket. And because so much of Democratic investment went to the presidential and is oriented around winning the presidential election, you know, that includes independent expenditures, party committees, affiliated PACs, all of that is focused on the presidential. That lack of investment in everything else means you have, and a decline of civic life over the last 20, 30, 40 years meant that there were huge places where there wasn't Democratic organizing outside of a state or local campaign. The maps just don't overlay in such a way that you can count on a singular national organizing effort. It is why Run for Something's focus is explicitly on state and local politics. It's why we believe in not orienting ourselves around a particular geography. It's why our ultimate goal is to get as many candidates as possible running for as many offices as possible, as many times as possible, because you know that that is how you rebuild this from the ground up. You do not count on a national Democratic Party organizing effort to save us, because it simply can't do it. There's too many pieces of the pie. We can't let them have all of the pie. We have to make some of the pies ourselves. That was a bad metaphor, but you follow.
I get it. I'm intrigued by this one thing. I hear a lot of, frankly, what I think is cope from a lot of progressives whenever it comes to state and local around not being able to reckon with culture and its role in that way that how people vote. And I would say that the prime example is Florida. Trump wins Florida by 3 points. That's more than Obama won it in 2008. Landslide by Florida terms. Minimum wage passes by, what was it, 16% something? A much larger vote. Those two things have not yet, I think, been grappled with by a lot of people in the progressive world, because they'll be like, well, people support our ideas, but people are not supporting us. So I'm curious from your guys' perspective, because this is going to be even more so, frankly, I think on the local level. Local politics, from what I can tell right now, is all about mask mandates and critical race theory. Frankly, neither of which they really have anything to do with, maybe more so on the critical race theory side. But I'm curious how you guys see. You both seem genuine. You want to pass some progressive policy. How do you get past that? It just seems insurmountable to me. I would say the same thing on the Republican side. You're going to run on culture and culture alone. That's the only thing you're going to win on. Nobody cares your position on tax policy. Sorry, Pete, you can take that.
Yeah, you know, this is one of our theories of what we're trying to do with Deepin, which is our shorthand for Democracy Policy Network, is we're trying to retrain the muscles in political and civic life, especially among candidates,
yep,
of talking, being policy first. And I think, you know, there's a lot of cynicism about policy first. You know, it's all about biography. It's all about if you can connect on values. And I think that's very important. People need to see themselves in your story. People need to feel like you're one of us. You know, there's all that stuff you read about. But I think it's condescending to voters to say that they don't care about what policy is institutional design, that they don't care about the design of the forms of life that they walk through in their day-to-day life, and that they can't handle hearing about all the and what we specifically focus on is alternative designs. It's currently going this way, and we're trying to train people in talking about there's another way it could be. And I think if you make it about the two big issues that are at the top of MSNBC and Fox News at the start, it will be a culture war. But one of our goals with Deepin is to show people the range of really exciting institutional alternatives that you can explain really concretely without kind of falling into these different categories. You know, let me give an example. You know, people say, oh, the entrepreneur party is the Republicans, and the Dems don't focus on that at all. But there's really interesting ideas about democratizing entrepreneurship, so that when you say we're doing business friendly policy, it's not just we're getting tax breaks and government handouts to Boeing and Amazon in like a faux HQ2 like race to the bottom. But actually, you know, learning that, you know, in Germany, they have these things called middle state. This is the kind of average thing we do at Deepin is we say, did you know in blank, they do X with Y, you know, yeah. So I'll just do an example of that. Did you know in Germany, they have middle stand competence centers, middle stand meaning middle sized businesses, small and medium sized businesses that are publicly funded, that are places anyone can walk into as a citizen of that region of Germany. They're all regional. And you can get help in learning about the cutting edge and vanguard best business practices. Did you know you should be using, you know, QuickBooks? Did you know you should be doing this? Did you know here's the way to register for your business? It's a publicly funded project of the government to help small and medium-sized businesses be entrepreneurs. What a cross-section. Talk about realignment here. You know, that doesn't sound like something you're hearing about. Mm-hmm. And when you get down to, you know, even these you know, even things that seem like they fall into, you know, let's take democracy vouchers as an example out of Seattle. In Seattle, when you, every citizen is issued a voucher that they can use to spend on campaigns. And so currently, when you're running for office anywhere outside of Seattle, you have to throw big fundraisers with the rich part of town. When you're in Seattle, and this has literally happened in the last 5 years, you can walk down the street, you can go to the poor side of town, and they have vouchers there, and you can host a voucher fundraiser. And we literally have cards we show on Deepin of literally come to our voucher fundraiser. It costs $25 in vouchers, in democracy vouchers, that you can send to candidates, and the candidates can cash them in for campaign cash. Passed in Seattle, lefty, radical place. What are you talking about, Pete? It also passed in a referendum in South Dakota, and a deeply red state. It did not become law because the South Dakota legislature declared a state of emergency that democracy was coming to South Dakota and we need to overturn the will of the people. But there is, it's just an example that in a deep red state, when you get really concrete, things can change.
Thank you, guys. I'm sorry about the scheduling problem. But
thanks so much.
Awesome.
I'll see you later.
So, Pete, I'm from Oregon, so anything Seattle is not close to my heart, but close geographically to me. I wonder, though, I hear about the democracy funds a lot. Has there been any empirical difference in the type of candidates who've run there? So, for example, you're clearly very strong in the social sciences, and then Amanda Althoff is to you, too. But it seems to me that there's like a causation correlation thing. So the type of candidate who is running in Seattle is probably going to have high name recognition. If they have high name recognition, they would obviously be able to throw a strong fundraiser. The city is basically effectively a uniparty state. So it's not as if there's like intense political competition. How has that actually played out in the state beyond the narrative accomplishment? Because I agree with the narrative accomplishment. I'm skeptical about the actual impact in that type of locality.
Yeah, I'll talk about it really quickly, concrete, and then kind of in the abstract for other issues. Concretely in Seattle, they've done studies of it. It was actually part of the law that they need to study it every year to make sure it's like living up to its mission. And it's drastically increased the amount of people that are donors. And most of the candidates use it. And it's not in the general election. Yeah, in the general election, the Democrats win in Seattle. It's really transformative in the primaries. And so that's where you're seeing where the types of candidates can run and win. And they're talking to, you know, the big kind of Lawrence Lessig campaign finance argument is that it's less about, you know, this direct quid pro quo and more about where are you spending your time. And it's proving that they're spending more time with a wider variety of people and you're seeing a wider donor base among Seattle, at least double. I don't have the exact numbers on hand and it's increasing every year. I will say on the abstract level, every policy innovation needs time to grow and take hold. And you always start with the usual suspects problem. You know, the usual suspects problem being when you have a new idea, the currently powerful players will be able to seize that new idea, figure out the rules of it, and win. But that's why the project of deepening democracy is not a silver bullet project. It needs to come in multiple forms, pushing at all levels, in all ways. And then, and to let a kind of democratic ecosystem grow, you know, we're trying to like grow a rainforest in a desert, and you have like different plants come up, sprout up, and you say, oh, well, you know, those plants aren't a rainforest. You can look at it that way. And you might think we're being, you know, we're doing cope when we're like, oh, look, there's a few sprouts. And you're like, well, you said you were growing a rainforest. But these things, you know, this is a 50-year project of deepening democracy. And, you know, you can see this happen before, like in the progressive era, you know, the direct election of senators and the, you know, professionalization of the civil bureaucracy and the, you know, invention of social service by Jane Addams and others, each of them one off, might have been like a rickety beginning. But over time, you wake up in 1940 and the country's really different than it was in 1890. And that's what we're trying to do, foster, grow, cultivate, and be open to experimentational failures too, of new ideas. We need more life in our political policy life. It can't just be the same old battles. It has to be, we have to have that spirit of democratic experimentalism to try new things out. But over to Amanda.
I just want to talk specifically about Seattle because I've seen this play out in real time. Remember Something currently this year is working with Andrew Grant Houston, who is a far left mayor, candidate for mayor of Seattle. He's 32 years old, he's an architect, he's queer, he's Latino African-American, he considers himself lower income, like is a renter, moved to Seattle 5 years ago, maybe. I talked to him for the Run for Something podcast, got to know him a little bit. We've been working closely with his campaign. The reason he is a competitive mayoral candidate is because of democracy vouchers. He was able to collect more than $350,000 worth of them, more than almost any other of the big named candidates running for mayor of Seattle, including the city council president, former city council members, other state reps, you know, nonprofit directors, that kind of thing. His success as a candidate in pushing the debate is totally dependent on that initial boost of support from folks giving him democracy vouchers. His ability to campaign effectively is built off of that. And he has said he's not sure he would have been able to jump in if he knew if that wasn't an option. And the same was true in New York with ranked choice voting, which changed the game for how we participate in municipal elections here where I live. I live in Brooklyn now. The number of young women and young people of color and further progressive candidates who jumped in because they knew that the system was more acceptable to people like them, it changes what you think is possible. So I trust Pete on all the numbers and the stats, but we hear this anecdotally from the candidates that we work with. They didn't think they could do this until the structure looked like it would welcome them.
That's a really great place to lead into the next question. I want to be very precise in how I word this because I don't want to get into, nor am I interested in a debate about CRT. I want to talk about it as a case study for how the two of you are actually approaching these things when they happen. So Amanda, you were quoted in Politico talking about this. We'll include it in the show notes, but you were just referencing that there are candidates in certain areas, especially moderate suburbs, aka the place that gave Georgia two senators who reviled Trump, voted for Democrats in the midterms, voted for Democrats at the national level in 2020, who, because of certain national issues with Trump off the ballot, could make the Democrats they elected very vulnerable. So let's pretend I come to the two of you. I'm listening to this podcast. I'm really excited about all these different things. I like taking out the trash. I like the local issues. I have this expansive thing. I sit for my first school board race, and all everyone is talking about is a debate over CRT, mask mandate policies. Let's say I'm running for the state house, an issue I never thought would be a huge deal, ballot procedures. That's going to be a huge thing in 2022 going forward. How do you two sit down and talk to somebody in the situation I'm describing? Policy aside, right? Like, let's just say, what do you say to someone who probably off the top of their head isn't going to be able to articulate fully the differences between Robin DiAngelo and Ibram Kendi? And like, well, actually, is this thing good faith or bad? Just forget all that for a second. What do you say to them?
Voters don't care. That's very shorthand. Policy is important because ultimately you're going to govern if you win and you need to actually do something with it. But the way that voters think about policy is most voters do not have a coherent or cohesive ideology. Most voters can't give you the difference between Robin DiAngelo and whoever. most voters don't really understand what these topics are. What they do want is someone who can think about it for them, who they can delegate the responsibility of giving a shit to, who they can delegate the responsibility of researching and engaging and listening to every possible perspective. So what Run for Something does when we work with candidates directly is help them find a way to connect with and communicate with as many voters as possible, to listen, to pay attention, and to really connect, not necessarily on the facts of the situation, which are certainly important, but what is the feeling behind it? And, you know, I talked about this with the Politico reporter for that story on critical race theory. You know, Democrats sometimes get in our head about, like, they're misdefining critical race theory. That's not actually what's being taught in schools. It's astroturfed, run by the Republican Party. And all of that can be true. And it is clearly tapping into an emotion people feel about what their kids are learning in schools. Can you, as a candidate, hear that fear or that anxiety, misplaced or not? Can you hear that fear? Can you take it in? And can you help make them feel like you are going to have their back? And it doesn't necessarily mean agreeing with them on policies, but it does mean making sure they know you don't look down on them, you don't condescend to them, that you understand where they're coming from. You know, we worked with a state house candidate who then became a state senator after 2 years later named Chloe Maxman, who is in Maine. She's 20, when she first ran, she was 26, so she's now 28, 29. She was a climate activist. She was running in a deep red, very rural, very white, very old part of Maine, one of the oldest, whitest, most rural counties in the state and in the country. And she told me how she would go knock doors and talk to voters who time and time again would say, I have never met a Democrat asking for my vote before because they don't think they can win it. And in fact, I've only maybe once met a Republican asking for my vote because they think they have it in the bag. And I asked Chloe, like, how do you approach these conversations of people who, like, do not align with you in any way on any issue? She was like, well, when they were wrong about the facts, I would, you know, kindly correct them. But mostly, I just tried to listen and not argue and tell them I was going to represent them whether or not they agreed with, whether or not I agreed with them and they agreed with me. I wanted to be their public servant and serve their interests and their needs, and that they could trust me because they knew me. That's a story we hear from candidates all across the country, that in fact, that personal relationship between candidate and voter, which, you know, studies have shown is the most powerful drive to get folks to show up at the polls, is a personal relationship between candidate and voter, can really overcome some of the bullshit, because it's easy to hate the Democrat you see on Fox News. It's easy to hate the sort of nameless, faceless monsters. It's really hard to hate your neighbor, Chloe, who's coming over to talk to you about what she wants to do for your kids' schools. You know?
I mean, this is interesting, though, because I want to understand, because I want to agree with what you're saying. But what concerns me, if you put the hat on the other, I'm not gonna even, we're really struggling with metaphors today, so I'm just going to drop that for a second. I feel like it's easy for you to say critical race theory scaremongering is bullshit. But I could easily see a version where we're talking to a right-wing mirror universe version of you who's saying, look, Democrats saying that I as a Republican want to enforce voter ID, that's all bullshit. Look at my values. Oh, Democrats are saying that I'm this like Trumpy person that you don't like in the suburbs. That's all bullshit. So it just seems that I just have a hard time. I'm having a hard time reconciling what you're saying with the national mood of what it feels like is going on in the country. That's more what I'm saying. What I'm saying is it feels as if everything could be hypothetically described by either side as bullshit. And if everything is bullshit, then nothing's actually bullshit. Everything is everything, if we're to really work with that there. So I'd just love to hear a response to my emotional feeling here as a prospective candidate.
Well, I know what I'm saying feels idealistic. And like, I'm a political operative. I'm not really an idealist. But I have seen it play out with the thousands of candidates we're working with in the conversations they're having with voters. Like, it is about practical, tangible stuff. It is about feeling seen and feeling heard. And you think about the national mood is one thing, but the way that people interact one-on-one is very different. And I do think that this is one of the things that got lost a little bit during the pandemic that I hope we bring back. It's why door-to-door canvassing is so important, because it's easy to hate someone in a comment section on Twitter or Facebook and hard to hate the person who comes to your door. Not impossible, but harder. Like, there is something really powerful about in-person connection with someone who wants to listen. I have not met, as I will say candidly, I have not met or seen as many Republican candidates who are willing to engage in that same way. And I do think that's part of sort of the ethos of the Republican tribe that's a little bit different than the Democratic tribe. There certainly are some, probably, but I will say generally speaking, there is a sense, at least among the Democratic candidates that I have worked with, the thousands of them over the years, that they genuinely want to engage with their voters, whether or not they agree with them. And I think that's really, like, we underrate how powerful that is and how connected it makes voters feel. Like, this is intrinsically tied to sort of the loneliness epidemic, the lack of institutions, the lack of civic engagement. A lot of it can be fixed by someone who's saying, I want to serve you, tell me what's on your mind.
Also, you know, when you talk to labor union organizers or people who really, you know, I like focusing on labor union organizers because there's a real, you know, a lot of people call themselves community organizers these days.
It's a literal community that you're organizing.
You know, like, it's labor union are doing a very specific thing. What, you know, Jane McAlevey, for example, the great labor organizer theorist, they talk about how they take shops that have, you know, half Trump, half Biden voter shops, or, you know, they wouldn't have seen the results of that election yet, like half Trump, half Hillary voter shops, or, and most, you know, a lot of people not voting at all and have never been politicized. And over 5 years of deep organizing, you know, Jane McAlevey talks about a famous nursing organizing in a huge region of Connecticut that's now like a total nurses union, is the major power player because of their organizing. They're able to rewire people's sense of meaning through interpersonal trust and solidarity of the long haul work of doing that organizing. You're totally right that the standard issue divides that were given nationally, if no one wants to put in the deep work of building trust and doing deep organizing, is going to be the red v blue, Fox News, MSNBC, you know, divides that we're inheriting. And that is the mood of the country, is that divide. But as you get more local and more concrete, you rewire these. And what, you know, there was a famous political scientist who once said the job of politics is drawing the dividing lines. And so our dividing line is between the, you know, the big political nations right now, Team Red and Team Blue, but in the culture war. But what union organizers do is they redraw a line where, hey, all of you workers are part of this circle and we're going to draw a line and start having negotiations with the boss on the other side of the line. And I'm really inspired by the politicians that are able to recreate that line drawing. So let's take CRT as an example. What I would do, you know, as a candidate is I'd start talking about what are the forces of governance that are acting on your kids' schools right now. So you're being told by Fox News right now, it's like the forces of CRT from the academy, but there are a lot of forces acting on your kids' schools right now. We are just coming out. We're just waking up from like 10 years of major education reform, which people on my side call the educational deform movement, that was funded by tech billionaires and the Walton family, that totally changed, you know, that totally forced kind of, you know, untested technology on all of our schools, that totally forced a standards and testing regime that now has a total bipartisan consensus against it. And let's talk about, you know, the campaign for commercial free schools out of Boston, that's talking about how, you know, we have tech companies and commercial entities that actually give awards for the best commercials that are able to get kids to ask their parents to buy them drinks that are poisoning their bodies. It's crazy. Talk about an intervention into the family unit from a centralized authority. And then I'd start, you know, I love the candidates that are able to retell these stories and show you that, you know, part of these divides are these more shadowy entities that are trying to divide you to not get into their game, you know, not turn on to their game that they're trying to pull on your kids. You know, the people trying to, you know, take over and defund our public schools, the gem of our country, the people that are trying to invade your kids and families' lives, they would love us to fight over, you know, fight the history wars, so that we aren't turning on to what they're to the fact that the naming rights of my literal high school's football field is after a Hummer dealership because we haven't funded it enough. And thus my eventual kids, when they're in high school, have to look at an ad while they're playing football. You know, I think we can start rewiring those stories as folks like Elizabeth Warren and others have done a good job of pointing you in the direction of the real power.
You know, this is really fascinating because I have been totally checked out of, I lived in DC. I now live in Brooklyn as well too, Amanda. So we're very Acela corridor. There's a specific like cultural space we're in. So if I'm struggling with what you all are saying, it's because I'm bringing a specific experience and energy to that. So like, I'm totally down to be disabused of that. I like the both of your answers on CRT. But maybe the podcast host in me just envisions doing this if I were a voter and either you gave your answers. I'd say, Pete, you know, that sounds good about the Waltons and Mark Zuckerberg. I don't like them. Blah, 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 blah. Amanda, that sounds great. You seem smart. You're really likable. That being said, all I really care about right now is, are you going to teach that white people are evil? Or is that not how actual conversation, because once again, like in the national political discourse context, that is the first instinct that I have to respond to what a hypothetical voter who I haven't met would say. How do these conversations actually work? Do you kind of get what I'm saying? I would just think that's what my instinct would tell me the conversation would turn into.
It very quickly goes, well, I want to make sure our kids are learning accurate history. And it goes from there. I'm curious, Drew, did you engage in the New York City municipal elections?
I'm very self-aware. I just got here. I got here in May. So I am not about to opine about various topics I know nothing about.
I ask if only because I'm a national political operative who works in local politics. And for national campaigns, like they don't really matter in New York City as a New York City voter. I found myself getting more emotions and more stress and anxiety and conversation about the New York City municipal elections that happened, I don't know, a month and a half ago. Than I did over the presidential, over, you know, congressional, over federal, in a way that reminded me of this thing that I do talk about all the time and that I work towards, of how personal it feels. Like, I read through, and maybe, of course, I'm a little unusual here, but read through every website and every policy position of all the city council candidates and all of the mayors and debated the mayoral ranked choice voting for hours over dinner with friends, because it matters. And it, like, being able to engage on this, on these local races, these local issues, yes, the conversation does sometimes veer into like ludicrousness. Are you going to teach my white kid that they're a racist third grader? When someone's starting from that premise, you sort of have to work your way back to a place of values. But most people are not starting from that premise. Most people are starting from a place of, I'm afraid about what my kid is learning in school. And then you use pretty practice, like pretty intentional repeat back. It sounds like you're really afraid about what your kid is learning. What makes you so afraid? You go from there. I do think that the conversation that most of our candidates are having, even in places where critical race theory is a really like prominent part of the discourse such that it is, are rarely about that. It's usually about housing, if I'm being honest. Most of these conversations our candidates are having are about housing. Second bucket would be healthcare.
Fascinating. Pete, what's your perspective on this?
Yeah, you know, eventually, if you're pressed on something, it's good to give an answer. You know, it's sleazy not to give an answer. I'm very inspired by the candidates that when they have another line, they give a direct answer and then they go back to their line that they were doing. You know, a great example is, you know, Bernie Sanders often would say, yes, yes, I agree. Or no, I don't think that's good. Now let me talk about the millionaires and the billionaires or something. And so I don't like, you know, I think this comes down to a lot of running for office is a, you know, an interpersonal, are you having a relationship of mutual respect with your voters? And so part of the relationship of mutual respect is answering their honest questions that they have directly and not trying to please everyone, and also not trying to have your answer be for the social media audience instead of the person right in front of you. Those are the two sides that you could fall into, you know, not giving an answer or giving like a dramatic stump speech answer for the likes. But it's also being honest about, you know, saying, you know, I see that you're asking that. I'm going to give my answer, but I also think I want to tell you about my priorities too. So, you know, it's, I think candidates, I think, you know, a good rule of thumb of who usually wins in elections, is the one that has more, is the candidate that has more life in them, the candidate that has more vision, you know, the candidate that says, I hear you. I'm going to tell you a story of what I think about that. And I'm going to tell you a vision of an alternative of what we can have. And I have all these different policy ideas of what can do. And I'm excited to listen to you. And I love being part of this district, you know, and I love you and I love me and we, I love politics. You know, it's great. We're all running. We're all debating. It's all disagreeing, you know, these happy, happy warriors. And so, you know, it's a balance of diving into the national issues and being honest, but also redirecting to your real priorities.
So here's the last big question for the two of you. I'm really curious how the last 4 to 5 years have shifted the type of person who runs for local office, the way that person's perform, the way that person performs their role as an elected official. So whenever we talk about this on the national level, we'll talk about how if you're an elected official, in Washington Day, it's everyone's getting a podcast. TV clips really matter. You're seeing this transformation of politicians from legislators who are bringing out their big bills to working more on building up their media profiles, because in a broken Washington where nothing actually gets done, perception actually matters much more than that. To your point, though, at the start of the episode, Amanda, none of that is true at the state level. So I'm just fascinated to hear from the two of you for our last question, how or how not are politicians changing at the local level, changing or staying the same at the state and local level in 21st century America? Let's go to you first, Amanda.
One Person Thing launched in January 2017 on Inauguration Day. We thought it would be impossible to get people to run for office. Nobody wants to run. Historically, that had been the case. We were like, we'll get 100 people in the first year. That will be cool. What a cool hobby this will be. We had 1,000 people sign up in the first week. As of today, we're up to more than 80,000, just about. 2021 has in fact been our best recruitment year yet. It's on pace, has already exceeded the entire calendar year of 2017, is on pace to include 2018 as well. Those are predominantly women, predominantly people of color, all ages 18 to 40, about a quarter to a fifth LGBTQ+. They are teachers and nurses and activists and scientists and refugees and veterans and musicians and rodeo stars and Chipotle managers and everything in between. They are running, they are winning, they are leading, they are serving. Yeah, many of them have social media presences. That's because they're 20 and 30 somethings who have been on social media for the last 20 or 30 years. Many of them are very good at social media. But again, when you're 20 or 30 something, it's a little more fluency. To watch them run and lead, and to then see the next class of folks who come up after them, who point to them and say, I'm Aaron, I'm running in 2018 because I saw Jennifer run in 2017. Jennifer gave birth to twins during her campaign. Well, I'm only pregnant with one baby, so I can obviously do this if she could do that. Oh, I'm Mary in 2020. I saw Aaron do it in 2018 and Jennifer do it in 2017. I can do this too. It is so powerful. And it's actually, you know, as I said a little bit earlier, I'm a national professional political operative. I'm not inclined to be particularly sappy or idealistic here. To see the wave of especially young people, especially for me, young women, especially young women of color, to run and win and lead is so inspiring because it makes you think government can be good. Government can be and do good if you get good people engaged. In fact, our institutions are only as good as the people who make them up. And we have seen some really powerful stuff happen on the state and local level because good people are leading. So that's a long way of saying that I think the last 5 years have wildly shifted what leadership looks like and who those leaders are. And we are only just at the beginning because it compounds on itself. It's a virtuous cycle. We are going to see, assuming democracy survives past the next 18 months, which maybe, if it does, there is so much good leadership out there who look different than what we've seen before and are going to lead differently in a way that's going to make our country so much better.
Last word from you, Pete.
Yeah, you know, I just want to echo everything Amanda said, and just from the policy angle, which is, you know, my role at Deepin, the, you know, if you look at polling in the Democratic primary, at the 2020 Democratic primary of people under 40, the three structural change major candidates, the ones that were talking about big, bold ideas for changing things and kind of branded themselves that way, had over, 60 to 70% of the primary electorate, which is that the people that are running for office and the voting base of people under 40. And I'm sure you're probably, I'm less versed in the other side of the spectrum, but I know that there is a lot of talk on the other side of the spectrum of people who want big structural change as well. And people kind of launching their campaigns as anti-monopolists or something like that. But across, there is a huge generational shift in the desires for big, bold policies. And we're seeing in the candidates that Amanda's talking about that are running, it's not just that they're, it's not just that they're a new generation of candidates, it's they're a new generation of being, politicians and legislators. And they're forming political co-ops, they're forming different caucuses to fight for bigger ideas, and they're staking, they're not waiting their turn for 30 years to have their big legacy idea be proposed. They're demanding it right when they win office and starting to fight for it. And so we're so excited by kind of, I think we're in a new, we saw at the last turn of the century, a flourishing of new ideas that kind of redesigned our institutional order in this country. And I think saved America 100 years ago by, upgrading it. And I think we're going to see another wave of that. And we're seeing it in the candidates, and we're especially seeing it in the last 5 years of people who are willing to rethink our institutions in a big way for the good. It can sound scary to some people, but it's mostly kind of looking at the really rusty parts of our institutional order and thinking about how can we change housing? How can we change healthcare? How can we change the way we do elections? How can we change the structure of our economy so that works for everyone and that we can have more power to more people in more ways? So I'm really excited about that with this new crop of candidates.
That's an excellent place to lead. Sometimes I get concerned we are way too, to speak to your point, cynical as more nationally focused people. So thank you for that, Pete, and to you too, Amanda. So this aired. The conference happened yesterday. We recorded this on Wednesday. Where should people go to go look back at what happened? And then also, you two run organizations. So moving forward, where should people look for your work?
I'll start then throw it to Amanda. To look at videos from the conference, all the conference's videos will be available to people. Go to statehousefutures.org. And if you want to follow my org, the Democracy Policy Network, go to democracypolicy.network.
And if you are listening to this and thinking, I want to run for local office, I might want to run for local office, I might want to think about maybe one day thinking about running for local office, run for something, would love to help you. The place to go is runforwhat.net to enter your name, your address, and see what kind of offices are available for you in 2022. If you want to learn more about the organization, we're just runforsomething.net, and we are here to help you.
Thank you so much. Good luck. Well, once again, everyone reviewed our recording times. Good luck with the conference, which is happening in 3 hours. Thanks for giving us a good amount of time before the big day.
Of course. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us on. Wonderful talking to you.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Reminder, Substack subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and most importantly, realignment conference signups. Not everyone who applies is going to be able to make it, but we'll definitely put stuff together in the future because we're getting so many awesome people who are reaching out. And of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.